good idea to measure HHPV couplings, and how this can help you distinguish between different cases where the Higgs mixes with a scalar, and how this can tell you what the electroweak quantum numbers of that scalar are. So then I'll just do a comparison between measuring Higgs couplings at the LHC and ILC, and this is to motivate measuring this HHVV coupling at the ILC, because we know that at the LHC it's really hard to do this measurement. And then I'll just quickly describe the parameterization of our couplings, and I'll introduce the three benchmark models. So these are basically models in which this coupling varies, and then the modification to just the HPV or the Higgs couplings to fermions are the same. So in some sense, in these different benchmark models, this is the only way of distinguishing between them. So I'll, and the way we, the observable is basically the Di-Higgs production rate. And so at the ILC, I'll talk about how you can use the production rates from E plus E minus to ZHH at 500 GeV. And E plus E minus to nu nu bar HH at 1 TeV. So you can use these to sort of extract HHVV and HHH couplings. And I'll also talk about using additional like kinematic discriminants, which can sort of improve this extraction. And so in the benchmark models, we made some assumptions. So I'll just address those after I've sort of gone through the results. So that's the viability of benchmarks. And then I'll conclude finally. Okay, so in terms of motivation, so we've entered the stage where you know, we have a sort of long-term experimental program of understanding what the exact properties of the Higgs are. So we're basically going to be measuring the couplings of the 125 GeV resonance more precisely. And in many extensions of the standard model, you have the Higgs mixing with another scalar. And you could either test these scenarios by looking for additional particles, or you could look for deviations in the Higgs couplings. So what we'll be focusing on in this work is where you don't see anything else. You've just seen the 125 GeV resonance, but you don't see anything else. So basically, any modifications to the couplings are what give you a handle on what the new physics is like. So, in general, you could have couplings shown here, and these can be different for different fermions. But we'll just be assuming that the CFs are the same for different fermions. And we'll assume that this new scalar doesn't contribute to electroweak symmetry breaking. So it doesn't have any coupling singly to pairs of vector bosons. And we'll also be assuming that the new scalar doesn't couple singly to quarks, and basically, or charged leptons, and this is basically to avoid stringent constraints from, you know, flavor-changing neutral currents. Yeah.
I understand that Bob Holden at the University of Toronto has a paper where he mixes with a pseudoscalar, which doesn't couple, only couples through loops to WZ and so forth. Bob Holden.
Okay. So, so could you say that again?
It's a paper on the outside.
Okay. And
he uses a six scale, not a scale.
Oh, okay. But so the thing is just so it's a mixed CPE state, is that?
Well, the center scale only couples through loops.
Yeah, but it's a mixed CPE violation.
Right. So in our case, the potentials that we look, the extended Higgs potentials, we are assuming there's no CP violation in our case.
Okay.
So basically, we're looking at cases where you modify the HPV and HFF couplings by some common multiplicative factor. Now, this factor is going to depend on the mixing angle. And so when you do measurements at the LHC and at the ILC, if it gets built, then you basically just measure the mixing angle, and this doesn't tell you what the electroweak quantum numbers are. So basically, the point of this work is that measuring the HHPV and HHH couplings can help to distinguish between models where the Higgs mixes with scalars with different electroweak quantum numbers. And measuring this at the LHC is extremely hard because the rates are really small. I'll go into details a little later.
Is this,
yeah.
Is this It seems like suppose I have some. Okay, so mixed with the Higgs, the new scalar has to get about.
So in if for example in the three benchmark models, the first one is a real singlet scalar, so it doesn't have to get a web. You can just write down some a term like this. If this
if it's
a singlet.
Okay.
But you're right, like if in the other two cases, you sort of have some amount of fine tuning. So basically I'm talking about cases where the web is zero or it's vanishingly small. In which case you have to sort of fine tune and change say parameters in the Lagrangian to get enough mixing even though the web is really small.
Well, I guess I also wanted to ask about your first assumption in that I can imagine having a new electrically charged state where the new state would modify the HBV
differently from
let's say triplicating about
you could get different modifications.
Yeah.
So I mean in our work we're assuming that doesn't happen, but I'll talk about sort of in the section on the viability of these models, I'll mention what you could do if these modifications aren't the same.
But I thought a new electrically charged state getting a rev, contributing to some extent electrical signature, will change HBV automatically.
Right, it will. So.
Or it'll change HBV relative to HFF.
Yes. Yeah. So I guess I don't understand the question.
Oh no, it just seems like that assumption is overly restrictive.
Okay, so right in so what you said is true, but this is HBB. Let's call this modification A. So in the three benchmark models that we consider, we have the case that is equal to C.
Okay.
But what you're saying is true. It doesn't have to be in general. But I'll talk about what you could do in that case at the end.
Okay.
So I mean, if they're different, you can still figure out what the mixing angle is and then figure out what the HHBB coupling is.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, no matter what, you'll have a common change in these, and so you'll mix in a new state.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the coupling with the original gauge eigenstate, the new state before the mixing,
mm-hmm.
You said the state doesn't couple directly singly to general fermions, but
right.
It's necessarily going to have the HBV. So that's what I'm asking about. I thought you were assuming that C is equal to zero.
Oh, no, so.
It's not zero automatically.
No. So let's see. So I mean, we are assuming that the contribution to HBV is really tiny from the other scalar, because it basically doesn't contribute to electroweak symmetry breaking, or it has a really tiny
value. Okay, so small means it's small.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry if it's a little roundabout. I mean. But yeah, once I introduce the modifications, it should be clear. Yeah. So I was here. Okay. So so at the ILC, you can, so at the LHC, it's extremely hard to measure this coupling. But at the ILC, you could look at E plus E minus to ZHH at 500 GeV, and then E plus E minus to nu nu bar HH at 1 TeV. And those two can be used to give you a handle on the self-coupling and the HHPV couplings. Okay, so I'll just talk about measuring Higgs couplings at the LHC. So we know that at the LHC, what you do is you have signal strength. So in general, what you're measuring is a production times a branching ratio. So this makes it harder to measure Higgs couplings at the LHC because you have to do global fits. And of course, there, if you have sort of a balance between having too many parameters and being model independent or making assumptions and sort of introducing model dependence. So here are sort of estimates for the accuracy in Higgs couplings. So this is with 300 inverse femtobond of data. And you can see that because of the hadronic environment at the LHC there, like Higgs to BB bar is really hard to measure. And And at the LSE, if we were trying to measure HHVV couplings, because the Dyhicks production cross section is really small, it's really hard to do. So this is at the 14 TeV LHC. If you had to get an idea of, you know, what the rate is like, so you can see that it's orders of magnitude smaller than, say, just Higgs production through gluon fusion. So, I mean, even with respect to the other couplings, there are lots of reasons for why you want to do better than, say, order 10% precision. And that's because in a number of new physics scenarios where, let's say you have a number of heavy states, you can have deviations that are smaller than this. So basically any beyond the standard model theory where you have some sort of decoupling limit, you can have the case where you don't see any new particles, but there are small deviations in the Higgs couplings. So this is sort of one of the main motivations for why you would want to build the ILC. And the reason the ILC does better is because, firstly, in general, the cross sections itself are much smaller. So if you looked at the total cross section for PP collisions, so if you do an estimate of a comparison of that with E plus E minus collisions, you can see that it's basically six orders of magnitude. So that sort of helps with making it much easier to measure these at the ILC. You also don't have issues with pileup or hadrons from the underlying event. And at the ILC, you can recognize Z and W bosons easily, even if they decay through the hadronic decay modes. And like I talked about earlier, at the LHC, you sort of measure the signal strengths, and then you need to extract the couplings. But at the ILC, you can actually measure the absolute branching ratios and the width. So if you started off at 250 GeV and you looked at E plus E minus to ZH, what you can do is you can actually tag the Higgs by measuring the energy of the Z that's recoiling against the Higgs. So you at E plus E minus, with E plus E minus going to ZH at 250 GeV, you can actually measure all the branching fractions really accurately. And then by measuring the total cross section, you could get an idea of what the width is, because that tells you what the coupling to Z itself is. And but if you were to use just this process to measure the width, the accuracy isn't very high. It's like 30%. If you combine it with E plus E minus going to nu nu bar H to BV bar at 500 GV, this gives the Higgs width to an accuracy of about 6%.
What's the second process? What's special about it? I mean,
So basically, you're just adding more. The rate at 250 GV is small, so you just have more data. So if you combine E plus E minus to ZH at 250 GV with this, you can shrink the inaccuracy on the Higgs width.
Okay, the new bar that coming from the Z? The kinetic code is the same production with Z goes to the new bar, or is it?
Right, and so that, and you could also have W boson fusion.
Okay.
Yeah, so because of the reasons that I mentioned on the previous slide, you can see that you can do much better than, say, 10% at the LHC, at the ILC. And so here, in this plot, we've sort of have three scenarios where the early stage of running of the ILC, which is at 250 GeV, and you gather 250 inverse femtobarns. And then there's the ILC at 500 GeV, and then at 1 TeV. And each of these roughly takes about, like, 3 years. So you can, I mean, you can see that you do much better. So, and at the ILC, you can actually get a chance to measure the HHVV couplings. So that would be basically, that's the coupling that we're talking about, and this. So at the ILC, if you looked at double Higgs production, then you get a handle on HHVV.
In this case?
Why look at the neutrino-rich final states at all?
Oh, no, so this is...
Why not have that diagram up there and just have this ego to the left, the chart?
Wait, Yeah, so the Z is allowed, in this case, the Z is allowed to decay to charged leptons, to quarks, or uniball.
It's better not to have neutrinos because there's missing energy.
But in the
Yeah. So in this diagram, you're right. We are including cases where the Z decays to.
I'm just wondering, like, there's no special handle that you're getting by looking at the neutrino case specifically.
What does the second row add to your understanding relative to just
doing? Oh, so actually, I mean, the idea is to use this at 500 GeV and this at 1 TeV. And the thing is, this cross section is much bigger at 1 TeV.
I see.
Right. Sorry.
And
yeah.
Is there a reason to do the neutrino case rather than using Z's?
Oh, yeah. So, right. So, the cross section with Z boson fusion is much smaller. It's like a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than this one. So, yeah, I mean, so what you should think of is doing this at 500 GeV and this at 1 TeV. OK, so. Just a quick review of how we parameterize our couplings. So in the standard model, each of these AI, BI, CI, and DI would be one. And in general, you could have CF be different for different fermions. And also here, I've written AV. But if you had models which break custodial SU2, then you don't, it's not necessary that AW and AZ are the same, or BW and BC are the same. Right. So in terms of sort of just visualizing, that's the HBV coupling. And then this is, so the modification with respect to the standard model is given by these multiplicative factors. So it's A, B, C, and D. So what we are after is basically measuring this coupling. Right. So in general, if you want to see how this coupling is modified, you could consider, let's look at the Higgs. So you have phi mixing with chi, which is the real neutral component of a general electroweak multiplet X. And since it doesn't couple to fermions, and because it doesn't acquire a web, you have just A is given by cosine theta, and C is given by cosine theta. And because you have the other chi is allowed to have a chi-chi VV coupling, you'll still get a modification to HHVV, which is dependent on the electroweak quantum numbers. So in general, if you were to work out what chi chi w plus w minus or chi chi zz is, you can work this out in terms of the isospin and the hypercharge. And if you look at how B is modified after mixing, you can see that it's basically, so Bw would be cosine squared theta plus a term times sine squared theta. And if you want to preserve custodial SU2, you basically have to impose that BW is BZ. And that sort of restricts your the hypercharge that you can have for different isospins. And the other thing to note from this is that you could also have BV be greater than 1, basically if T is greater than half. OK, so I'll just introduce the different benchmark models. So the first one is really simple, where you just have the standard model plus a real singlet scalar. So you have, in this case, B is cosine squared theta. So in each of these three different benchmark models, we'll look at cases where A and C are the same, but B is different. So in this case, B is cosine squared theta. Now, if you consider the standard model plus an inert doublet, so if you have a type 1 two Higgs doublet model where the web of the other of phi 2 is really small, then the modification to B is basically it's unchanged. So it's B equals 1. And the third case that we look at is what's called the Georgi-Mahacek model. And in this model, you have two triplets. You have a complex triplet with hypercharge y equals 2, and you have real triplet with hypercharge equals 0. And you sort of arrange it in this way because if you had just one of those, then you would violate a custodial SU2. And you can see that just from this expression. Right. Right. So that's the Georgi Magic model. So we have three models in which you have A and C having the same values, which is basically cosine theta. But B is cosine square theta in the first case. It's 1 in the second case. And it's greater than 1 in the third case. Right. So in the Dodder A matrix, you have you can basically have two custodial SU2 singlets, so H10 and H10 prime. And you have some mixing between them. And so this is how B is modified. So you have, so you can see that you have cosine square theta plus 8/3 sine square theta. And this, so this allows the mixing to be greater than 1, the factor to be greater than 1. So in terms of measuring the HHVV coupling, so the scenario we're looking at is if you, from LHC data, if you figure out that A and C are 0.9, then you can still have these three different benchmark models and you haven't been able to distinguish between them. So with the 250 GV ILC measurement, you can find A to a very high accuracy. So you can get to precision of like delta A over A to be 1.3%, which is 250 inverse femtobarn data. And then you can use these two processes. So you can use E plus E minus to ZHH and E plus E minus to nu bar HH to sort of measure B very well. So what we do is we look at the cross sections for these two processes. And we assume that Z boson fusion is negligible here, because in this process, the cross section contribution due to that is much smaller. So what we do is we calculate the cross sections using CalCAP for Dihigs production for these three benchmark models. And so this table has sort of the cross sections for these three as compared to the standard model. Right. So here, so these cross sections are going to depend on B and D. And they're also going to change with the center of mass energy. So if you were to look at a plot of B versus D, and this is the cross section of E plus E minus to ZHH. So you can see that in terms of B, it's not monotonic. And this feature will show up later on when I show chi-square plots of the best fit. And on the right, we have E plus E minus to nu bar HH. And the cross sections here are in femtobarn. So the idea is just that for if you had a plane of B and D, you can calculate what these cross sections are at each point, and you can find like the chi square with respect to your reference benchmark model. So what we do is we compute cross sections where we fix A equals 0.9 and D to 1, and as we vary B and D, you can just find chi-square for each of the benchmark models. And we look at 68% and 95% confidence level chi-square plots. And the idea here is, can those plots, like, do these contour plots distinguish between the benchmark models? So in terms of getting the uncertainty on these cross-sections, we just looked at the detailed baseline design report for the ILC. And the thing is, this is going to depend on the cross section for the process, and we just saw that that's different for the different benchmark models. So we scale those appropriately. The other thing we had to account for was in this process, nu bar HH, you also have a contribution from Z to nu, and if you have cuts, they sort of get scaled by a different amount. So we accounted for that by ensuring that we scaled the ZHH process so that the relative efficiency was about 11%. So this table here is a table of delta sigma over sigma from the DVD report. And this is sort of the relative uncertainty on the cross section with two inverse femtobarns. And you can see that if you compare it with the standard model, as you would expect, when the cross sections are higher, the relative uncertainty gets smaller. So if you compare the Jajai matchsec model where you have a B value of 1.32, you can see that your relative uncertainty decreases. And if you compare that with the cross sections, that makes sense.
Is this just statistical?
Yeah, it's just statistical.
What's the background situation?
When they found these, the main backgrounds they consider are from like TT bar, ZZZ, and ZZH. So, it seems like there's still some way to go in terms of their analysis. So the main things that help you distinguish from the background are like jet clustering. So in your final state, what you do is you cluster jets so that you basically are looking for ZHH. So what you do is you cluster your jets, and then you find a chi-square. So chi-square between, say, two jets. Maybe I should write this down. So essentially, if you have six jets in the final state, you basically combine the jets in such a way that the difference between that. So, oops.
Let's see. In other words, you want to reconstruct the
right. You basically want to make sure that if you have six jets, then you cluster them in such a way that you get a Z, an H, and an H.
Okay.
So that's one thing that helps distinguish. And the other thing that helps is in cases where the Z decays to like leptons, you look for isolated leptons. That helps to reduce the background. So, in terms of like the detector simulation, they probably have still some more work to do. Yeah, and I mean, these uncertainties are just based on the number of events they see, so it's just statistical uncertainties. So yeah, so based on this, once you calculate the chi-square, if you look at the 68% confidence regions, so here for the Jajai matchsec model, you can see the green curve, and then the B equals 1 case is the case of the inert doublet, and then B equals 0.81 is the real singlet scalar. So you can see at when you plot the 68% confidence level contours, you have a separation between at least the Jajai matchsec and the other two models. So you can at least distinguish that from the other two cases. And even at 95% confidence level. So here there is some overlap. But still, the overlap isn't, you know, significant. And this crescent shape that you see is because of what I mentioned earlier, where the cross section isn't monotonic with B. So some things to mention about this result are that in the report, when they figured out what the relative uncertainty is, they assumed a Higgs mass of 120. So that would change things a little bit, because the Higgs to BB bar branching ratio is higher at 120 GeV. But you can make up for this by also including the case where Higgs decays to WW and W plus W minus. So that would make up for what you lose from going from 120 to 125 GeV. So I'll also talk about, we just looked at total rate so far. But in addition, you can look at the Di-Higgs invariant mass to sort of improve the extraction of B and D. So the ILD collaboration has looked at a way to improve their sensitivity to D by reweighting events. So if you looked at these three processes and you looked at what their contribution is in terms of to the total cross-section, you can see that there's quite a bit of interference. And if you looked at the contribution from diagram C here, which depends on the self-coupling, you can see that it rises at it sort of peaks at lower dihigs invariant masses, and the contribution because of B is sort of broader in MHH. And so what you could in principle do is if you reweighted events based on what the dihigs invariant mass is, then you can improve your precision. And so this improves the precision on D by 10%. At the 500 GeV and 1 TeV. So what you could do is you can adapt this to also improve the extraction of B and D. And so you can see here, I mentioned these things. Yeah. So if you looked at dihigs invariant mass plots for WBF at 1 TeV, then these different, so the black curve here is the standard model. The green one is the Georgia match sec model. The red is the singlet. And the blue case is the doublet. So here, these different models differ just based on B. So that you can sort of see that characteristic when you look at the dihigs invariant mass plots. So when you consider these three diagrams, B and C interfere constructively. So if you looked at the plots for either Georgi match sec, which is the green plot, or the doublet case, which is blue, you can see that when you compare the shape of that with the singlet case, it's peaked more at lower MHH. So if you compare this shape with these two.
So just to get an idea, if you assume that the ILC detector is comparable to, say, the LEP detector, then what kinds of uncertainties do you think would be appropriate for these curves? And would they be able to discriminate between the cases of the LEP?
So the idea is that you, so I can talk about reweighting. So the idea is you won't actually look at, so these shapes, what you'll do is you'll reweight them and look at your total cross section. And basically the idea is to improve your sensitivity to the variable you're interested in. So D, for example.
So there's no sense in which you could use this analysis to just study the shapes and tell which of the models.
I don't think they're, like, the rates are definitely not that good. Like, you can't just look at, like, this is an exaggeration, like, where you see the shape really clearly. So B and C.
So what's the mass resolution in these diamonds?
So the actual detector, I'm not really sure what the mass resolution is because I mean it's
not a smear of these distributions.
Right. Yeah, that's true. But I don't think that's been finalized yet. Between B and C, you have. You have destructive interference, and between A and B, you have constructive interference. So if you looked at cases where you had larger B values, then you can see a flatter spectrum. So if you compare the doublet case with the singlet model, so that's this, the blue curve versus the red one, you see that it's flatter. Okay. So in terms of what, like independent constraints on D from the LHC. So there was this recent study where they looked at basically taking the ratios of dihigs production to single higgs production. So if you look at dihigs production in the LHC, you have basically processes where the cross section is going to depend on the top Yukawa coupling, as well as it can vary with if you have new particles in the gluon fusion loop. So Basically, D can be, what they found was D could be constrained to be positive at 96% confidence level using 600 inverse femtobond data at the 14 TV LHC. And if you had a lot more data, you could sort of reduce that to plus 30% or minus 20%. But in this study, they assumed that C equals 1 and that there were no new particles in the loop. So in principle, a joint analysis with LHC and ILC data can be used to constrain B, D, as well as new colored particles. So I'll just talk about the viability of the different benchmark models. So so what I talked about, we just looked at diagrams that you see in the standard model, and then we modified A, B, and C, and used that to calculate the Dihiggs rates. But in general, for these other benchmark models, you're also going to have contributions from the SU2 triplet states, as well as the heavier Higgs. So we didn't include those, but basically what we are assuming when we do that is that these heavier states are heavy enough that they're kinematically forbidden at the 1 TV ILC. So basically that just puts constraints on what MH has to be heavier than, and what the MH plus minus and MA0 have to be heavier than. So if you sort of see what happens when you include these, the contribution from these states as well, we check for one of the cases where, like in the inner doublet case, basically it increases the Dihiggs cross-section only by about 3%. But the thing is, you can't just assume that these heavier states are arbitrarily heavy, because they also needed to make sure that your theory is unitary. So to look at constraints that you get from perturbative unitarity, we looked at these two scattering processes. So you have VV going to HH and VV going to VB. So the V here can be W's or Z's. And the longitudinal polarization is important because that's where you see the bad high energy behavior. So just a quick review of what the unitarity limits, where do they come from? It just comes from being able to write your amplitude as a sum of partial wave amplitudes. And the cross-section in each partial wave is limited, so you can use that to constrain your amplitude. So basically, we just look at the real part of the amplitude in the zeroth partial wave and constrain that to be less than half. So if you looked at the process VB to HH, then in the standard model, you have these contributions. So that's the factor of B, and then the red dots are A, and that's the self-coupling. So here you can see that these first three diagrams have order E squared over V squared contributions. So if you had SU2 triplets that are exchanged, you would have to include those to unitarize this, because that's the only way to have an order E squared over V squared contribution here. So you definitely need the TNU channel exchange to restore unitarity when B is not equal to A squared. So using that, you can get constraints. You can get upper bounds on what the masses of these new states have to be. So for a value of A equals 0.9, you can see that these are constrained to be less than about 2 TeV and then 1.3 TeV. So those are the constraints that you get from VB going to HH. And you can also look at constraints from VB going to VB. And in the standard model, you have these three diagrams, which each of them have their order E to the 4. But like when you combine them, they give you an order E squared over V squared dependence. And just in the standard model, these cancel out so that it's unitary. But if you have modifications to these couplings, then you need something else that unitarizes it. So using that, you can get a constraint on what MH is. And for an A value of 0.9, it's constrained to be less than 1.6 TV. So you can see that you can push these values high enough without running into perturbative unitarity constraints. So in terms of like some of the assumptions that we made, so if A is not equal to C, then basically what we had assumed was that the other scalar doesn't participate in like two-week symmetry breaking. So, and we also assume that custodial SU2 is not broken. But there are lots of models in which these assumptions don't hold. So the question is, what do you do in those cases? Then, basically, if what you can do is, if you measure A and C, and they turn out to be different, you can still find what B is in this theory, because if you look at the Georgi match sec model, for example, you measure C, and then C is not the same as A in this case, because B chi is not zero. But you can still solve for what the mixing angle is and what V chi is using these two equations. And because you have to still get the W and Z masses, you know what V chi has to be. So basically, you can still solve for the mixing angle and the web of the other guy just based on A and C, and you still have a definite prediction for what B is.
Mm-hmm. If you write the mixing as a 2x2 matrix,
right,
of diagonal mix, mm-hmm, what's the interaction of mixed and fixed? What is the interaction? Something has to interact between the two scalars to give an off diagonal mixing contribution.
So usually in these cases, if you just have something that's like a Higgs-Portal term, so if, let's say you write down, if you allow for these two to get webs, then you'll have, if you write down your basically terms that are quadratic in these fields, you'll have terms that are H times phi. So then these, if you were to write down a 2x2 matrix, then the diagonal elements are 8 squared, phi squared, and these are the off-diagonal elements. So it's basically, it's this new term that you can write down.
So it's the coupling with the Higgs.
Yeah, it's this Higgs-Portal term that causes mixing.
QCD, the eta nuta prime mix, the superscalar. Mm-hmm. Mixing is due to So you just make a model.
Yeah. I mean, if you extend the Higgs sector, then in general, if you were to write down the general potential, then you would have terms like that are allowed. And in the case where you have custodial SU2 being broken, then in that case, BW is not the same as BC. And there are lots of well-motivated models for this as well. Like if you had a complex triplet, just a complex triplet would break custodial SU2. In that case, what you have then is you need an additional measurement because you can't just rely on two rates to measure B and D. So you'd have to look at either additional kinematic discriminants or information from the ILC to sort of figure out what these three quantities are. Okay, so the other thing that we still have to look in detail is electroweak precision constraints. So for example, in this paper, what they looked at was if the Higgs mixed with another scalar, then what are the constraints from electroweak precision tests as well as from the LHC. So they found that basically there's this region for heavier, where the heavier scalar is like between 1 and 1.2 TeV, where it's detectable. And that's basically because its width sort of becomes narrower because of that's modified by sine square theta. But you can see that even with like beyond 1.2 TV or so. Like if your mixing angle is such that S8 squared is less than 0.1, you're still safe from electroweak precision test. So, I mean, you can have new physics that still allows for, that can compensate for the changes to the oblique parameters when a is 0.9. But if not, then you're certainly safe for a equals 0.95.
Why is it detectable line cut off at 1,000?
So what they looked at was the heavier Higgs mixing to two small Higgses. I think in there, they just didn't look at points below because they were interested in like trans TeV Higgses.
Okay.
So that's like in their paper, they don't consider things below that.
And is detectable LHC detectable? Or is it
LHC detectable. Yeah. And it's basically happening because the width reduces, because the width for the heavier guy is modified by the mixing angle. So normally, if you had a 1 TeV Higgs, that would have a really large width. So that width reduces enough that you can see it. Okay. And I mean, we still have to look at the electroweak precision constraints for the case where you have the inner doublet and the Dodge Matchstick model, but it shouldn't be too hard because you have sort of enough freedom in those models. So to conclude, basically, if the Higgs couplings show deviations from the standard model, and you don't see any other new particles, if you want to figure out what the electroweak quantum numbers of the new scalar are, then it's important to do a direct measurement of the HHVV coupling. And at the LHC, this is a really hard measurement. So at the ILC, it's still accessible if you looked at Dihiggs production. And in the past, Dihiggs production has, in all these studies, they basically focus only on the self-coupling. But we're trying to motivate the case for where you should also look at the HHPV coupling modification. And so you can look at the processes that I mentioned at 500 GeV and 1 TeV, and you can extract these two couplings separately. And in addition, the LHC should be able to have an independent constraint on D. And yeah, that's basically it.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah.
What is the motivation for including these scalars and each double models? I mean, if you're looking at the
So a lot of these models, for example, like if you take the Georgi Matchstick model, this is a model from like the mid 80s, and it was introduced at a time when people were like, we don't understand how SU2 cross U1 is broken. So you sort of want to explore all the different ways in which this can happen. So you look at extended Higgs sectors where you can have SU2 plus U1 breaking. So, and you want to look for cases which have like relevant experimental signatures. So that's why.
Doesn't solve the hierarchy problem.
No, I mean.
Just testing alternative dynamics, the left instead of the right, right? But it's still essentially perturbative physics that's doing it, but somewhat more complicated.
All right, well, let's thank our speaker again.